welcome to episode 85 of season 11 Movie by Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Mark Hoffmeyer of Movies, Films, and Flicks, and of the Deep Blue Sea Pod. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
I got Wi-Fi, cable, coffee maker, and this foxhole I'm in.
There you go.
That's really nice. It's more of like a basement now than a hole.
You're right, especially if you're just in a hangar,
I buried a storage container and I'm in there. That's how thorough it is.
Well, just make sure that nothing lands your way.
No, I hope not.
You know, but then again, maybe you'll just have like a cameraman show up and start filming it.
Well, there already is one.
You never know.
This isn't a video podcast.
No. Sorry, just audio.
I'll just have me on camera then.
Maybe.
Hey, Rick, you can go home. Sorry, man.
All right. So, episode 85 begins with Buck responding to Luz, and ends with a cameraman filming the men.
Hey, good talk of a cameraman. See.
There you go. See? There you go. And so we ended things yesterday with Buck just getting reassurances from the guys that they're not going to do anything stupid, that they're going to make it out of here alive. You know, even though we all know that one thing has absolutely nothing to do with the other.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, not doing something stupid is not necessarily going to keep you alive, or doing something stupid is not necessarily going to kill you.
If you do something stupid, you could go the opposite way of where you're supposed to be, you know, and live. If you do something smart, you could still catch a. That's a tough one. That's something you can't promise somebody.
You can, but you can't necessarily live up to that promise, because, you know, in the moment, you might decide to do something stupid in the moment. You know,
I think. You know, I never served in the military. I wasn't in World War II. I wasn't in the kind of stress that these people are in. But I think, you know, telling someone not to do something stupid when all of that is going on, that's a big ask. Because sometimes I've met people who, like, forgot a cucumber at the store and they freak out. So it's the mental fortitude of these men who had to fight through the European campaigns and then in Japan and any combat situation. I don't think... you'll never be able to understand it unless you're there. And it's like every other thing, but man, that's tough to just keep your head on during all that chaos.
Right. It's true. So at this point, with all the chaos that's going on, Buck responds to Les and goes, yeah. And Buck just gets up and leaves. And then Pinkala turns to both Luz and Muck and goes, don't do anything stupid. Who the hell is he talking to? A bunch of morons. He goes, a bunch of morons who volunteered to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. Can you get any more stupid than that? Which I think is a great line.
Yeah, that's a really good line. And then we get the barrel bit, which I love.
And he goes, probably not. He goes, right. And then Muck goes, well, I swam across Niagara once. He goes, yeah. And Les starts laughing. He goes, I swear, on a bet. He goes, what? In a barrel? No, I didn't go over the falls, George. I swam across the river, 10 miles up from the falls. I tell you, that current is damn strong. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, must have carried me at least 2 miles downstream before I got across, but I got across. Now, personally, I didn't think it was all that stupid, but my mom, my sister Ruth, they gave me all kinds of hell. Yeah, I bet, Muck. And he goes, so did Faye. Les goes, ah, sweet Faye Tanner. He goes, shut it, George. And then Piccolo goes, well, they did have a point. You're an idiot.
I love that line.
but they give it some very interesting things to ponder in this conversation between them, which again, I love this conversation. It's they're doing a great job of letting us get to know these guys, you know, even just a little bit more about about their lives, about things that they've done, you know, things like that. I mean, I'm not sure if you were aware of the fact that Skip Muck is the actual connection between Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, because Skip Muck was friends with one of the Nyland brothers.
Oh.
And the Nylands are the brothers that the idea of Saving Private Ryan came from.
Well, that's interesting.
So yeah, and then you know Skip Muck is from I think it's Tonawanda, New York. I think that's what the name of the town is. And that is where where the Nyland brothers were from.
Hmm.
So yeah, I like the fact that there's a connection between them, you know, between them all here.
The line readings are so good.
Yeah.
In this. You know, when you see a lot of these actors in other films and they're not as great as they were as the characters in Band of Brothers, you get a little bummed out. But you also it makes you realize how good Band of Brothers was. And yeah, I don't know. I love it because you are an idiot. Like, what a good I love, but it's not mean though. Like, it's just
no, but it's a weight between, you know, friends can jibe one another that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type of thing.
I mean, that makes sense. Someone who's young swimming across the Niagara, that's happened a bunch.
Right.
I mean, 10 miles out. So, I mean, that's a believable story. I like that's 10 miles out. Like, that's because there's still, he's an idiot, but there's still, he's not that much of an idiot.
Right.
If that makes sense. He's not doing it like 500 yards out. That would be an idiot.
Correct. I mean, listen, he was born in 22, so therefore he was 21 at the time.
Wow.
No, he was 22.
Oh, so
this is the end of 44, so he was 22 already at that point. It wasn't the beginning of it.
So he had 2 years of training. So he was in his teens when he did it. I did so many stupid things in my teens. I probably would have tried to swim across it, so, you know.
Well, you just have to watch out for yeah, falling ice sense. In St. Louis. That's what you got to do.
Yeah. Oh, man. That was... I'm still angry
And I
about
still
that.
Remember that story. You see, Mark, after all these years... I know.
I could have died. Man, I can't believe I went along with that. You know when you just figure people know what they're doing? And then, like, I was like, yeah, that was bad. I'm still you know what's funny? So whenever I go to class, I just look up now. And so I think that really scarred me because I'm always looking up. Even when it hasn't snowed, I feel like something's going to fall on me. So that definitely stuck with me. Also, when I was driving home one night, a car just pulled in front of me. No time to brake. It was their fault. All the witnesses were there. It was their fault, whatever. I had nothing dinged against me on my insurance or any of that. But now when I drive and I see a car pulling out a little bit, I get really freaked out. So between the ice and that, those two things have stuck with me. Yeah, just want to put that out there. Well, everyone
it's important. If everyone's driving behind Mark, you got to make sure that you know, you're aware of these things.
He hits his brakes a lot. Yeah, give a few seconds behind right. me. Don't
see what's interesting about the whole idea of the story that Skip gives us here is that Tonawanda is basically almost a 30-minute drive from Niagara Falls. So like, how would he have even gotten there? If it was, I mean, again, he was a kid.
Older brother, or just one of his friends had a car.
That's true. No, but
bus?
It had to be the guy who made the bet.
Something
with.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. They were probably just there. But do you think they were there when they made the bet, or do you think they drove there because they bet each other?
You know what? It makes more. Because
if I live 30
that
minutes,
they were there. Maybe they were like on a school trip.
Yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, and then one of his friends says, hey, Skip, I bet you can't swim across. And like, a bit I can. And then he jumps in and just swims, tries to swim across. And, you know, the teacher probably got hell from the whole thing because, you know, if he got swept two miles up from the current, that's not good either. Two miles downstream.
Exactly. You know, I got to tell you, though, if I ever had a student who did that and they survived, I would be annoyed, but I would also be really relieved.
Well, obviously you'd be relieved that they lived.
I was like, you're an idiot, but you lived. So let's just go on with it. So it's not one of those things where you're just happy right. They survived. So you're not too mad. Does that make sense? We're like, okay, crisis averted. You're an idiot, but you're not dead. So let's just go back. So that's one of those situations where you're like, you almost forget about what they did, right. And you're just happy they survived.
That's true. Okay, how long do you think, what is the length of the Niagara River?
Ooh. Well, it's coming from the mountain. Coming out of, I don't know, 237.
It's 36 miles. Basically, the Niagara River connects between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. Okay, so it's a 36-mile thing. And what do you think the widest portion is? You know, because Skip had to swim across it. So what do you think the widest portion was? I mean, I can't tell you exactly, you know, 10 miles down what the distance is, but what do you think the widest?
100 meters.
No, it's a little longer, little larger than that, but the widest. The widest.
Okay. 150. No,
the widest is at the crest of the Horseshoe Falls, it's 790 meters. Okay, but obviously,
whoa,
you know, most of the rest is going to be a lot less. So, you know, it's even possible that, you know, Skip had to swim across 100 meters. It is possible. You know, it's not necessary. It's not necessarily true that he had to go across almost 800 meters. You know, when he was swimming across.
Yeah, it opens up as the falls.
Yeah, you know, it's 10 miles up. So,
and also, you got to swim with the current and then just slowly make you, like, when a rip current takes you don't fight it. You just swim parallel with the shore. So I got something, you know, I lived by beaches pretty much my whole life until I moved up to Atlanta. So to get out of a rip tide, you swim parallel with the beach. So I wonder if he just swam with the current and slowly made his way over. Cause you're not going to swim, you know, directly towards it. And you,
right. Yeah. But again, it depends also how
that makes sense.
How old he was at the time.
Yeah. A lot easier when you're 16 than when you're in your 40s.
Right. The information that I got is actually pretty interesting. He swam from Tonawanda across the river to Grand Island, New York. So apparently he didn't have to go all the way to Niagara Falls in order to, you know, Niagara Falls itself is 30 minutes away. But the river apparently goes by Tonawanda. And it says that, you know, because of the powerful current, he reportedly touched shore 2 miles downstream. And he did it at night as part of a fraternity initiation. And apparently Fritz Nyland, his best friend, followed him in a rowboat just to make sure that he wouldn't get in any trouble along the way.
Oh,
yeah,
and that's a lot less fun.
Yeah, it's safer. Safer. He doesn't mention this part, and that's why Pinkala says you're an idiot. Because, you know, I thought ahead and made sure that Fritz was nearby in case anything would have happened. And there's the Tonawanda All Heroes Memorial in Nyawanda Park. Basically, is very close to where he swam across. Interesting. You see the wonders of the internet, where you can find more information about Skip Muck's stupid things that he does.
We never would have learned this in 01, that's for sure.
That's
we
right.
Just watched the show and thought it was great. And you
wouldn't have even thought about it anyway.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, so there's a lot of people who, you know, they mentioned about the barrel, and there are a lot of people who have gone over the falls in the barrel.
And lived?
Yes, and lived.
Wow.
The first survival was a woman on her 63rd birthday. Her name was Annie Taylor, and she successfully went over the Horseshoe Falls in a barrel that she padded with a mattress. And this was in 1901.
Legend.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, she's. Why would a 63-year-old teacher decide that that's what she wants to do? You know, to be the first person to go over the falls. I don't know if getting in a barrel and going over the falls is going to be the my first thought of if I said I want to be famous. Yeah.
So, that's a legend, though. It was made of oak and iron. A bicycle pump? Oh, she pressurized it?
Maybe.
Someone used kayaks and jets. Someone used a jet ski. Oh my gosh.
Right. So the second person to do it successfully was 10 years later, a guy named Bobby Leach, and he in 1911 he broke both his jaw and both of his kneecaps.
Wow.
In that. And apparently between 1901 and 1955 there were only 15 people that attempted the stunt. How many of those 15 do you think survived?
Well, all right. I saw that 10.
10 survived out of the 15?
Yeah.
Very good. You're right.
Whoa. That is the answer. Well, you know, I just did like 15. I was like, at least a third's got to die.
Right. There you go.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Apparently doing this is extremely illegal, and the participants face heavy fines. There was a guy in the 80s who did it who got a $500 fine. I don't know if that's considered a heavy fine. You know, at that point, even.
yeah, that's.
And the funniest thing I find about this is about this woman, Annie Taylor, that before she decided to do this, she sent her cat on a test run.
No.
Yes.
Did the cat live?
From what I understand, yes.
Well, that's horrifying.
Yeah.
Oh man. You know, Jesse Buckley, who's up for an Oscar for Hamnet.
Yeah, of course, and at this point, we will now know whether she won it or not.
Yeah,
I think she does deserve to win it, but you know, we will have to wait and see. You know, everyone who's listening knows the answer.
I'm a big fan of hers, but also she said in an interview that before she got married, she told her husband that it was either her or his two cats, and she forced him to get rid of his two cats because she's not a cat person, and that bummed me out. Because I have two cats.
The fact that this is a family program, I'm not going to make the comment that first popped into my mind when you told me that.
But that, like, yeah, she told him that she didn't want cats, and so the guy had to get rid of his two cats, and she said it was a win.
I hope he still thinks it's a win.
Those cats are my family members. I would never do that. Just putting it out in the world. Nothing to do with Band of Brothers, but I have a band of cats who I love.
That's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And you know, once again we see a bunch of them in digging foxholes. And we see Lipton cleaning a Luger, and we can obviously tell that or assume that it's Hubler's Luger because you know Lipton was the guy who was holding the Luger at the end of what happened earlier this week. And then out of nowhere Dyke shows up and we hear his voice and he goes, "I heard about Hubler. Shame." And Lipton goes, "Yes, sir. It is." And Dyke goes, "Is that it? That the Luger?" He goes, "Yes, it is." Goes, "What are you going to do with it?" "I don't know yet." Now, it made me think that Dyke is going to say, "Well, I'll take it."
"Well, that's mine then." And then walks away.
Yeah, exactly. And then he goes, "Well, where are you from, Lipton?" And he goes, "Where'd you grow up?" He goes, "Huntington, West Virginia." "Huntington?" "Yes, sir." He goes, "Don't know it." Now,
yeah.
Have you ever seen The Dirty Dozen?
I don't think so. I think I watched it years ago, but I can't I see it in my head, but I can't ever remember sitting down and watching it.
All right, add that to your list. You should probably see it. I think you'll like it. So there's a certain point where Donald Sutherland is pretending to be a general incognito, and he's doing he's checking the troops, and he's walking through, and he stops at one guy and goes, "Where are you from?" And he goes, "Columbus, Ohio." He says something about Missouri, I think it was, and he goes, "Never heard of it." And he continues walking by, like, just that could be the biggest insult possible.
I feel like I've seen that scene. Why do I feel like I feel like I've seen that scene? Has he been in other Sutherland been in other World War II movies?
Kelly's Heroes.
Oh, that's what it is. Okay.
Yeah, but there he's
kind of a maniac.
He's not a maniac. His name is
Oddball. There it is. Oddball. Yeah, there Oddball. Yeah, that's how I know it. Yeah.
Okay, but Oddball isn't the one who says this quote, you know.
No, but I'm just I think when you said Dirty Dozen and then you said Sutherland, I think I saw his Kelly's Heroes character in my head. Does that make sense?
Right. Okay, so the actual quote from the Dirty Dozen is, "Where are you from, son?" And he goes, "Madison City, Missouri, sir." And he looks at him and goes, "Never heard of it." And keeps walking.
Oh, man.
So,
do you think they stole that from this?
I think it's the opposite. Meaning, do you think they stole this from that?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Maybe the book was out. I'll have to ask Graham Yost.
Do it.
I'll have to try and remember that I want to ask him that question.
Never heard of it. I could. Sutherland. I can picture him saying that.
Right.
I've watched I'm telling you, I background watched it. This is really odd that I'm thinking about this, and I'm not lying, but I know I've watched Dirty Dozen, but I know I didn't really watch it with all my attention. I think I watched it because I felt like I had to, because I'm seeing scenes in my head.
All right, well, you should see it.
Yeah,
Maybe you're just thinking of, you know, that the in Sleepless in Seattle, they talk about it. You know, maybe that.
No. I'm telling you, I let's see, what year did it come out?
1967.
Yeah. Let me see. No, Jim Brown. I remember that scene at the end. I don't know.
Jim Brown, Charles Bronson,
Lee Marvin. Yeah, no, Cassavetes. I remember that. Of course, Telly Savalas. I've watched it. I've just watched so many movies in my life that I feel like my brain is a bucket full of water. And with everything that comes in, something comes out. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. You mean like a full bucket of water?
Yeah, full bucket of water. And so anything that comes into it, something's coming out, getting pushed out.
Interesting.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of movies. I had to watch 100 and something Chris Pine, Pratt, Hemsworth, and Evans movies one time for a data article. And that's like 100 plus films. So I got a lot going on up here.
Okay, but you get paid for that. So that, you know, I'm doing it for free.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. That was a good assignment. I had to watch every single Dragon Ball Z episode and count all of Vegeta's screams, which are in the 1000s. That was a big job.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I counted all the explosions in Michael Bay's filmography. It was like 1600. I almost went insane on that job.
Well, hopefully they paid well and that it was worth
it. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you can go read them now, but... I guess you're living a good life when you get paid to do that, but
right.
Yeah, there's just a lot going on around. I think I remember stats more than actual scenes in movies.
Because you're a stats guy, I know that.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. But this, all right. So that's
okay.
I checked this.
I looked up to see if there's any like famous people from Huntington, West Virginia, and there's a hell of a lot of them. Mostly in sports.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a bunch of basketball guys, a bunch of baseball. I mean, there's nobody who... Steve Yeager. Interesting. Okay. Steve Yeager, who was a catcher for, I believe, the Dodgers. And he was an MVP of the 1981 World Series. So there you go.
Brad Dourif. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Chucky.
Yeah.
That's not bad. Matt LaFleur. No, Matt Lauer.
Ah, Matt Lauer. Okay.
The pride.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to, you have to, right, you have to make a different, you have to make a differentiation between the art and the artist. There you go.
You know, we have to, I gotta say here, we haven't gotten to it yet, but when Dyke walks into that tree branch, that's a very funny moment. Like, the guy's just so aloof that he can't walk around branches. I just love that scene so much.
I think that's part of it. I think it's part of what they're trying to show here.
Yeah. He just disappears, completely vacant, empty talk. He does remember Huntington, which I'm impressed by.
Well, it's, you know, it's not something that seems usual. So it makes sense that he would, you know, remember from that perspective, I guess.
I love that acting decision of walking into the branch. And then just his reaction to it, like,
I mean, we'll never know the real answer. But do you think it was on purpose, or you think it was like, do you think, first of all, A, was it on purpose, and B,
yes,
was it the actor's choice to do it, or was it the director who said, "Why don't you do that"?
You know, they gave freedom on this. The barrel story wasn't in the original script. The guy had heard about it from someone. They let them include it,
right?
And so I think the guy just walked into that branch. That's my thought.
Okay, again, it makes a lot of sense for Norman Dyke to do something like that.
He's just so aloof that he walks into a tree branch.
Yeah. And then he goes, "Well, what kind of work did you do there?" And he goes, "My brother and I helped my mom run a boarding house. And your father? He was killed when I was 10, sir. Automobile accident. That's sad. So, what made you decide to join the paratroopers?" He goes, "I read an article about it in West Magazine. Talked about the training, how hard it was. Said if you made it as a paratrooper, you had to be the best. And I wanted to fight with the best, sir." He goes, "You miss it? Miss what? Huntington. Honestly, sir, I try not to think about that much." And then he goes, "Where are you from, sir?" And then he turns around and sees the Dyke has disappeared.
Walked into a tree branch.
Just, you know, exit stage left, you know, that type of thing.
I love the laugh too when he does it. When he just kind of chuckles, like, "Oh, it's this guy."
Yeah.
Is Dyke trying here?
Is he trying?
He's trying, right? He's trying to do the best he can by making this conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is, but
he's just not conditioned for this kind of life.
No, not at all. Don't they? I think they mentioned in the previous part, or maybe it was even in part five, you know, that Dyke is basically, you know, he got the job because he's the nephew of somebody or something like that.
Yeah, I remember the exact, he needed some experience. They had to send him out for some experience just to say, "I served at this point."
Yeah, I don't know if the Battle of the Bulge is what you really want to have on your resume, but, you know, you don't want to pad your resume with that. But nobody knew.
No, definitely not. But I saw combat.
Yeah.
And then you get a raise.
Exactly. And, you know, Lipton just looks back and just shakes his head and chuckles. You know, like, what an idiot Dyke is.
I think a lesser actor would have looked annoyed.
Yeah.
But Wahlberg played it so well.
True. True. And then we get a fade, and then a Jeep shows up, and we see a guy get out of the Jeep. And, you know, a guy who is completely wrapped in as much wool as possible. You know, we get a shot of him looking down at the screen, and he goes, "Captain Nixon. Captain Nixon, sir." Nixon then, you know, gets out of his foxhole, you know, from under his blanket, and goes, "What?" He goes, "Good morning, sir. Sorry to disturb you." He goes, "This came from division." And he gives him like some sort of letter. And Nixon takes it and goes, "All right." And Nixon's a little annoyed that he just got woken up. But, you know, Ron Livingston does a nice job with that.
And he doesn't have any of his VAT 29. Is that what, VAT 60?
Yeah. And then he waves the guy off. I love that. He's just like waves him off. Yeah, like servant. Just leave. I don't need your help anymore.
Those rich Yale guys.
Yeah. And then we see in the mirror that Winters is once again shaving. And, you know.
With excellent nose work, by the way. Everyone's red noses are perfect.
Yes. It's true. It's true.
What's the coldest you've ever been? Like, what's a time where you just thought to yourself, so I was just in Vermont. It got down to negative 10.
See, I
very
up,
cold,
I
but I was bundled.
I grew up in Michigan. So, you know,
oh.
I grew up where it was really cold. But I haven't lived there in 30 something years. So, you know, like now, if I were to go back there, I would freeze my ass off. Yeah, I'm not used to it right now. So I can't really tell you when the coldest I've been was. Again, the climate where I live now is very different than Michigan. that goes without saying.
Very true.
You know, it does get a little cold here. It gets down to, you know, down to like 25, 30 degrees, but, you know, that's about it. but not below that. Not, I mean, in Michigan, it would go below zero. That's for sure. Fahrenheit.
Yeah, horrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Nixon shows up. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the episode 6 when we saw Winters shave. But I love the fact that they're constantly showing us how much of the perfect soldier Winters was. You know, that even in this type of situation where usually everyone else has scraggly beards and stuff like that, he is still making sure to shave. You know, and you can even see.
That's a leader.
That's right. And you can even see the cuts on his neck. Meaning that as much as he is doing this, he's still injuring himself along the way sometimes. You know, but this is what a leader does in order to show everyone else that this is what you do.
I'm surprised he's shaving up though. He might get some pretty good shaver's bumps from that on his
Maybe.
Neck.
Maybe.
But I mean, it's winter and it's winter
right.
And he's cold. He's just trying
that's
to shave.
Very good. And then
and Livingston has a beard.
That's right.
Like a scraggly over, so you can just tell the difference between the two guys.
And so Nixon shows up and he's holding a letter in his hand and he goes, "Morning." And Winters looks at him and goes, "Lou, eviction notice?" He goes, "Not quite. But I think that's something that will help you with your leadership problem." He goes, "Oh, Dyke's being transferred? No. I can't help with that. But division decided to pluck one officer from each regiment that served in the heroic defense of Bastogne, send him back to the States on a 30-day furlough. Get him out banging the drum for the war bond drive. That kind of thing." He goes, "It turns out I've been plucked." "Hey, that's fantastic, Lou. Good for you."
"How does that help
me?" He
goes,
"Thank you. How in the world does you leaving help me?" Now, what's great is when Winters gives this line, we see his face, and we see he's got shaving cream on his nose, shaving cream on his ears. You know, it's just all over the place. I guess when you just have a little mirror like that, it's more difficult, you know, from that perspective. So Winter says, "How in the world how in the world does your leaving help me?" "It doesn't. I'm not going. I've already seen the States. I grew up there. That's why I came to Europe. Just wish they told me there was a war on. The point is, this thing's wasted on me. But I'm sure we can find an officer somewhere in this battalion who could use a long trip home." And first of all, I love this conversation between these two guys because once again, it establishes what type of friendship these two guys have.
Oh, yeah. They're buds. Yeah.
They're definitely buds. And again, they will be buds for the rest of their lives for the next, 50 years. Which is also amazing.
You know, I think I've been on screen with Ron Livingston.
Oh wow, cool.
When I moved to Atlanta, I didn't know anybody. I had no money. I was just trying to like get what I could. So I got this extra job on the odd lot at Timothy Green. And they ended up liking me because I just showed up on time and was quiet. So I got a bunch of scenes in a factory where I had a kid, I had to pick him up a lot, and then I was like walking through the background. There was like 200, the day started with like 200, ended up with about 4 or 5. And then I was just there kind of helping, doing rounds and like doing all that. And then he was in a scene with his wife, Rosemary DeWitt. And I think I'm in the background of a shot with Ron Livingston.
Oh, wow.
So that was a fun day. I thought like every extra job was going to be like that because everyone was super cool and like nice. But then I learned that wasn't it. So I only did it for a couple more months and I ended up getting a real jobs. But yeah, I remember that. I remember when he walked on set, I saw Ron Livingston. And you know, at that time, you know what's cool about Livingston? He has Office Space and Band of Brothers. Those are two movies that are just that have transcended, or you know, properties that have like transcended time. Mm-hmm. And so he has two. That's pretty good. Some people are lucky to have one. That's right. He has Band of Brothers and he has Office Space. And Swingers, not, I wouldn't say Swingers is up there, but he has two that are just big.
Yeah.
So but it was kind of cool seeing him because it's like, oh man, that's Ron Livingston.
Yeah, that is cool.
But that made me happy.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And also I love the transition here. They just have like, you know, right as he says, you know, we could find an officer somewhere in the battalion who could use a long trip home, the shot changes and we see everyone like cheering around Peacock. And then Bumble goes, congratulations, Lieutenant Peacock. I can't think of anybody who deserves this more. He goes, thanks. And they go, I'm really glad you're going home. Now, the fact that Luz says that makes it sound as if Luz is basically saying, you know, I'm glad you're not going to be around to screw up and get us all killed.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you're going home. Well, I don't know.
If Lipton was sent home, everyone would be like really bummed.
That's right.
But since it's him, they're like, all right, well, that's cool.
That's right.
I like that.
That's right. He goes, okay. The best news I've heard in weeks. Hell of a guy. Hell of a guy. And Pika goes, thanks, guys. I mean, it really means a lot, you know. Oh, get out of here. You go, three cheers for Lieutenant Peacock group. Hip hip hooray. Hip hip hooray. Hip hip hooray. You know, and I mean, what I love about the way that they do this is that, you know, just a few minutes ago, Winters was explaining, you know, how much he likes Peacock, but how much he knows that Peacock is not the right person to be in this position. You know, so here we have an opportunity.
That's good leadership.
That's right. We have an opportunity to, quote unquote, promote him and send him somewhere. And this way, you know, keep us safe and keep him safe at the same time also.
Well, I mean, not too safe, right?
Right. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Now, one of the things that makes what I wonder is, okay, so Peacock's been plucked and is going somewhere else. Fine. Are they bringing it? Do they get a replacement for him?
Hmm.
You know that you're now one man.
Do they? Do they ever talk?
They
about
never
that?
Talk about it. They don't talk about it.
Oh. Hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, not here. Maybe they talk about it in the book. Okay. Here on page 161 of the book. So it says Sergeants Rader, Randleman, Muck, and Christensen, and Corporals Robert Marsh and Thomas McCreary gathered at the CP. Martin suggested they sit down. Lieutenant Sterling Horner, Peacock, and Foley were there. Horner spoke first. Your platoon commander, Lieutenant Peacock, has been awarded a 30-day furlough to the States, and he leaves today. He explained that the PR man at Division HQ thought it would be a great idea to send one officer from each regiment involved in the heroic defense of Bastogne to the States for a war bond drive and other publicity purposes. Colonel Sink decided to make the selection by drawing lots. Captain Nixon won. Peacock came in second in the 506th. Nixon said he had already seen the States and didn't want to go, so Peacock got the assignment. Everyone looked at Peacock, who stammered, I've been awarded this furlough. I feel certain because of the great job you men did in Holland and here, and the only thing I can say is thanks. Sergeant McCreary jumped up, ran to Peacock, and started pumping his hand. Boy, am I glad you're going home, Lieutenant. That's the best news we've had since we left Mormelin. Peacock, completely misunderstanding, blushed. He said he felt overwhelmed. That praise from one of the men was the highest praise. The sergeants smiled at each other. They were feeling as happy to see Peacock going as he was to be going. The non-coms felt that they had carried his load throughout Holland and the Ardennes. No one tried harder than Peacock, Christian declared, but it was a job he was not cut out for. Peacock announced that Lieutenant Foley was taking command of the platoon. Then, with a cheery good luck to you all, he was gone. So, yeah, there you go. So I guess I was right with what Luz said that basically we're glad you're going home because you're not keeping us safe.
We like you, but leave.
More or less. Yeah. But I like the fact that in the book they explain the fact that they drew lots. And, you know, why would someone come in second? You know, like when you're drawing lots for something, you say, okay, this is the first one. This is number one. And we're going with number one.
Yeah.
You don't need number two.
No. I guess if someone says no, but I don't think that works like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Peacock will return later.
He got to the bottom of it.
But still, you know.
I need to read this book.
I understand that.
Do you read a lot of World War II books?
I don't have that much time to read. I watch a lot of World War II movies.
Got it. Yeah, I used to read a lot about like Operation Mincemeat and stuff like that. I used to love reading about World War II.
Of Operation Mincemeat, of course.
Yeah, and just I used to read a lot of books about World War II. But yeah, you're right. That's There's only so much time.
That's true. And then the last few moments of this 5-minute segment, we get to see shots from what looks like a camera, you know, an old camera from that time, you know, taking newsreels, I guess you could say. We see Dyke, we see Muck, we see Fincala, and then we see a shot of a guy with a pipe, who's actually taking the shots. You know, he's the cameraman. And as he's taking those shots, this 5-minute segment ends. So, yeah, it's just very cool. So, Mark, is there anything else you want to say about this 5-minute segment?
No, it's just more smart writing. This is just such a smart show. It's kind of annoying. Just the conversation, the reactions of Lipton. The way that they deal with, you know, getting someone out of there, the conversation between the two, the shaving, you don't even have to say anything, and then just getting rid of him. Like, it's just, once again, it's just smart.
Right.
It's just
good. Yeah, well, good again, they just did this so well.
It's too good.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I guess there's no such thing as too good, but here, I will ask you a question that I've asked numerous guests of mine. Do you think if they made this now, if it would be as good, or do you think it would they wouldn't have been able to do what they did?
Well, I think there's such a thing as lightning in a bottle, and so something about this period when they shot it just worked. And I think Masters of Air is really good as well, and I think The Pacific is good. I don't know if any of them are as strong as Band of Brothers, but I think that between the casting, the sets, the builds, the direction, the money, the power, I mean, Spielberg and Hanks were huge, you know, they were top of their game at this time. Everyone was just huge, and they still are now, but I feel like all the circumstances just came together so perfectly that I don't think you could recreate it. I don't. And so great things are still being made today. You know, you watch Andor, you watch other shows. So I think if it was made today by the same people and with talent, just as good, it would be a good show. But there's something about this one that just gelled and hit lightning in a bottle. So I don't think so, because this is such a rarity. This is the number, three highest rated film on a TV show on IMDb ever? Yeah, I mean, I like it more than Breaking Bad. I got tired of that show. So stuff like this happens very rarely. And so I'll say because of just how well it came together. I would agree with you on that. There's
but
no
I also
knowing
think
it.
Part of the magic of this is that you do get the interviews from the real veterans. And the real veterans, and the veterans were also giving
that's
input
a great point.
As this was being filmed. So, you know, that also helped a lot. Because now, if they were to make it now, they wouldn't have that, which is one of the reasons why I think Master of the Air is it's still great, but it's not as great because none of the men are still around. You know, so it's hearsay on hearsay as opposed to directly from the horse's mouth, as they say.
Man, the amount of times you just want to tear up while listening to these guys talk.
Yeah.
You know, it's
seriously.
Yeah, you know, I wish I would have met my grandfather. So my grandfather is originally Van Wyck. He was his last name was Van Wyck. He survived the Battle of the Bulge. He drove convoys through it, transportation trucks all through that, drive at night with the lights off, and he drove transport to the front line and everything, and he survived all of it, came back home, and then scaffolding fell on him on a farm.
Oh wow.
So I would have loved to have learned about that. So whenever I think about that, I kind of like this kind of war, I think about my grandfather. And then my grandmother remarried to Eugene Hoffmeyer, and that's where the Hoffmeyer name comes from.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, I think the stories help, just learning about that, the emotions. But I'm telling you, this was, I truly believe in a thing called synthesis, where it's just something clicks, or actors click, or the casting agent clicks, and you just get something that, I don't know. Yeah, but I think your point's really good. I take that point about the narration by the actual soldiers and the intros by the soldiers. But, you know, I think like with any classic, Star Wars, there's so many things that went into it. You can't just say it would be better if it was made today.
Right.
Or worse.
Exactly. I completely agree with that. Excellent. All right, so we will now play the today's game is World War II movie trivia. So I will spin the wheel, and we're going to see what Mark knows about some World War II movies. So around and around and around the wheel goes. Let's see what we're going to get. Okay, in the movie The Great Escape, how many men escaped from Stalag Luft 3?
Oh, man. A lot of them are captured.
I'm not talking about... No. How many people escaped from how many men got out of the camp? We're not talking about what happened to them afterwards.
Oh. I don't know. 17.
76. 76.
Okay. I was wrong. I had 7 right.
Yeah, but at the wrong end of the number.
I'm telling you, I consume so much stuff that's hard to like retain these little facts. Okay, what do we got next? Okay.
That's fine. All right, let's spin the wheel for your next question. I told you, there are a lot of Great Escape and Saving Private Ryan questions, so you never know. Here, you get a Saving Private Ryan question. Okay, who played the actor who was the fake Private Ryan?
Nathan Fillion.
Exactly.
Hey.
Perfect. All right, let's spin the wheel again. Round and round and round the wheel goes. What famous musician starred in the movie Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence?
What famous musician starred in Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence?
Yes.
Sinatra.
Okay, the movie came out in 1983.
Famous musician. Neil Diamond.
David Bowie. David Bowie.
I'm telling you. Oh, okay. I got one right.
So far, you still got 2 chances.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Let's spin the wheel again. See what we get for more. Okay. In the movie Saving Ryan, once again, who is the first main character to get killed?
The first main character to be killed. Okay, so well, isn't it Vin Diesel's like Capuzzo?
Caparzo. Hey. Very good. Very good. See?
2 for 4.
You got that. There we go. You got the 2 right questions so far.
Yeah.
All right, let's spin around for the 5th question, and let's see what we get.
You can do it, Mark.
Okay, in the movie Stalag 17, have you ever seen Stalag 17?
But keep going. Okay. I want to see if I can get it.
All right, what TV show was created based on the idea of Stalag 17?
What TV show?
What TV sitcom has that? Does that maybe help?
A TV sitcom? MASH? No, that came from a movie by Altman. Okay.
That's right. Okay.
What sitcom?
Okay. Do you know what Stalag 17 is about?
No. What's it about?
It's about POWs during World War II.
And it's a sitcom?
Yes.
Oh.
Do you know of a sitcom that deals with Allied POWs in a prisoner of war camp? during World War II?
No.
Okay, the answer is Hogan's Heroes.
You know what's funny? In my head, I was thinking Sullivan's Heroes. I had and then I was like, but that's not right. So I had Heroes in my mind. I was wrong. You know what? I should have just said that. Okay. Two for five. I'll take it. And I want everyone to know we did two up. My attention span's gone after about 2 hours. So I did good. I got 2 out of 5. I'm happy.
There you go. All right. And now we will spin the wheel for the daily game of Name That World Worst Movie. So round and round and around the wheel goes. This is a movie from 1955 based on the story of Audie Murphy and what he plays himself in this movie.
And came out when?
1955.
And he plays himself?
Not Eddie Murphy, Audie Murphy. Yes.
What is it?
Audie Murphy was the most decorated soldier in U.S. history.
The best times of our life? What is that? No, I know the real life soldier played him.
No, you saw that. That was 1946.
Yeah, that was 46. Yeah, we did. That. Oh, I joined you for that one?
No, not me.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, I did that one. Yeah, 55. The Green Berets.
No, it's called To Hell and Back.
Okay.
To Hell and Back, yes. The story of Audie Murphy.
I'm telling you, I have so many movies floating in my head.
Another movie you should add to your...
To Hell and Back. I'll add it.
All right. So, Mark, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Mark Hoffmeyer?
Still in the foxhole.
Still in the foxhole. All right. And you're probably still going to be there when we come back.
That's right. I'll be listening to the movie Stones and Flicks and Deep Blue Sea podcast. I'm just in my foxhole. More like a basement.
There you go. That's the way to do it. All right. And you can find me by just doing a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moveyourminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moveyourminute@moveyourob.net. So Mark is going to join me for the weekend, and we will both be back on Monday to continue talking about Band of Brothers. But until then, everyone have a great weekend, and curry!
Curry! We'll deep blue see you next week.